Hi, I'm Monse, and this is Musings of the Artist, a podcast where I have meaningful conversations with all kinds of artists.
Janelle Lynch is a New York-based artist whose images reveal an inquiry into themes of connection, presence, and transcendence. She uses an 8x10-inch view camera, and her recent work is deeply informed by her training in perceptual drawing and painting. Janelle's photographs are in many private and public collections, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the International Center of Photography, and the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. She has three monographs published by Radius Books, Los Jardines de México, Barcelona, and Another Way of Looking at Love. In this deeply honest conversation, Janelle speaks about influence in art, her practice, her expanded view of the word family, and ambiguous grief. If you'd like more of the conversation, there's a written portion with Janelle over at musingsoftheartist.com. I'm so excited to finally sit down and have this conversation with you. It's been a long time coming. When did we meet? Was it about a year ago? Less than a year ago?
I think. When did the main media course start? May 2021.
Gosh, you're right. It's only been about 6 months. Mm-hmm. Feels longer. Mm. I wanted to begin, as you probably know, because I know you've listened to this, to the podcast. I like to begin with this big question, and that is, so you are a visual artist, which we're going to talk all about, and as well as a writer. And how would you begin to describe yourself beyond what you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I would describe myself as a fighter in the best sense of the word, a seeker, and a lover of beauty and light and color. A gentle warrior.
Oh, I love that. And that all sounds like you, from what I know of you.
thank you. Yeah, it's a phrase borrowed, as you might know, from yoga, which I have practiced for over 20 years now. But I really feel or relate, or the pose and the name of the pose, gentle warrior, actually all of the warrior poses really resonate in my body. There's warrior, there's peaceful warrior, gentle warrior. And when I move in, and particularly into warrior, I'm like, okay, this is who I am. I really own this. And it feels good.
And you know, you just used the word borrowed, and I think about a lot. You've in your teachings, and when you talk about your own work a lot, you talk about borrowing and influence, and how your work's been greatly influenced by literature and nature. And I would love to talk about this topic with you of influence in work and. And how other artists' work informs your own.
Yes, I would love to. In fact, when I do give artist talks, my influences and references make up a big part of what I do talk about, because they have really informed what I make, how I think. What I do.
And how do you because I think I remember you saying maybe in our the written interview about how Mary Oliver's poetry informed a body of work. And how did you notice that? Was it because you read her work and then you went out and made work and you sort of felt the stillness of her words or whatever you felt from her words in the work? Like how did that translate?
I read Blue Iris when I was making Another Way of Looking at Love, a body of work that I made between 2015 and 2018, up in the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York, my now former property. Let's see. I love the question. I think that I felt a kindred spirit, a connection with Mary Oliver. I felt so excited to discover another voice who has the same kind of or a similar kind of relationship to the natural world as I do. She expressed hers through writing, and I expressed mine through image making. But I felt buoyed and accompanied and inspired by her sense of it's almost a kind of permission in a sense of really celebrating the natural world and celebrating a sense of wonder and awe and joy and reverence. So there was a I think that hers was one of the first voices, really, that I, first literary voices that I felt a deep connection to in that regard. And so it fueled me I often began my day's work reading a poem of hers, and it really just helped me find or connect to that state of mind and being to begin the day's work.
Right. That's beautiful. I've been thinking about this a lot as I've been reading so much. I mean, I've always read a lot, but now, of course, I'm reading even more than usual for my program. And I've been thinking a lot about influence in art, and also just the ways in which other artists open doorways for us, you know, just things that can be brought to our attention that may have been buried deep inside that we weren't even aware of until we read something or saw something that showed it to us clearly. And I just, it's so exciting. And it's also another thing along those lines I've been thinking about is how, you know, I know you've talked about the need for solitude. And I very much relate to that and that need. And I was sort of thinking today on a long walk about how like, what is that? You know, like, why do I feel like I need maybe more space than the average person, you know? Maybe not the average artist, I guess, but the average person, you know, out there. You know, that I would much rather spend time alone than in large crowds or, you know, all these things. And I was sort of thinking maybe because as people, as much as we love to consume art and take it in, it requires a lot of space, right, for us to spend alone in our thoughts with these works. I don't know if that resonates at all, but I've just been thinking about that, about how it's like, I almost get overwhelmed by all the obsessions I have with all these pieces of art, you know?
Well, Monse, you're an introvert just like I am.
You're right. It's true.
That explains a big part of it.
Good point. There is a word for it.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
It also relates very much to, speaking of another reference, another influence, one of the greatest that I think will possibly inform, well, who knows what it will inform, but Charles Birchfield, the American watercolor painter, is another. He was, I've had some really good teachers, but I discovered Birchfield's work in 2006, so 7, 8, 9, almost a decade after I really began seriously photographing. So Birchfield was an American watercolor painter who was born and raised in Ohio and then lived his adult life in Buffalo, New York, near where I grew up in Jamestown. And I was introduced to his work in 2006. So his subject was, like Mary Oliver, the natural world. And also like Mary Oliver, he had a deep reverence for nature. But again, it was a different kind of permission that I felt through Birchfield's work. It was, he very much animated or anthropomorphized the natural world in his, the natural world and actually the man-made world through his paintings, in his paintings. And he was insistent upon the transcendent power of nature, and also had quite a solitary temperament, despite having five children and a spouse. Bertha was her name, and he understood the power and capacity of light, and light was also a very, very important part of his painting. So he has deeply informed my photographic work, and much like Mary Oliver, and similar to what you just said, he had a very solitary temperament. So, something that we share.
Lovely. And yeah, if you just thinking about, before we move off the topic of influence, can you share, because you always give such robust, beautiful lists of artists that you're, you know, thinking about or enjoying. And could you maybe share a few names of artists that really mattered to you and to your work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've named two, Mary Oliver and as a poet, and Birchfield as a painter. Matter to me today. I'll tell you somebody that I really enjoy looking at. Just find such great pleasure and delight and satisfaction in looking at is Richard Leroyd. He's either Scottish or British. I think he's British, and living in the UK. And I'll mention Stephen Shore. He was an important teacher of mine in graduate school and after graduate school. He encouraged me to use the 8x10 camera many years ago when we met, actually 22 years ago. And it was the right choice for me, the right camera for me. I didn't start using it until 2006, but it is still the camera that I use today. He was very important to me. Stephen Shore was very important to me, and really his teachings form the foundation of my practice today. But in terms of somebody that I look at today and really enjoy and admire, I've mentioned Richard Learoyd. I love Barbara Bosworth's work. She's in the Boston area and also uses a large format camera and works in the natural world. But, you know, I look at a lot of painting. I look at more painting than I do anything else. I just, before I left New York in November, I went up to the Guggenheim and looked at Etel Adnan's show of paintings. And she's somebody that I've enjoyed. There's a painter in me, and I am really, really drawn to the medium. So it's what I look at primarily.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that that's really in you. And I think I know you talk about how important painting and drawing is to you. Can you talk maybe, I'm just so curious if you could talk a little bit about how you found that love, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're mostly known at this time, or at least in the past, for your photography. But of course, it's also known that you're very passionate about the both writing and drawing and painting. And I'm just really curious about how you found all of these art forms and how they've and the different ways that they feed you. If that question makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was painting. I mean, I was painting, I suppose, like a lot of us do, from an early age in school and at home to a degree. And started writing and keeping a diary when I was 10. And photography too. I was born into my grandfather was an amateur photographer, and so I lived with him and my grandmother, my maternal grandparents, for the first, well, he was alive for the first 4 years of my life. So that was a very natural introduction to photography. It was a part of life from my earliest memories, really. Some of my earliest memories have something to do with photography. And I got my first camera when I was 10. So because there was that familial relationship with the medium, and it was a medium that was more known and more common, it was encouraged. I got my own first camera when I was 10. But I continued photographing into my teens and high school, but I was interested. I mean, I wanted to be an interior designer, actually.
Really?
Yes, it was what I wanted to. It was one of the things I wanted to study when I left high school. But I was also very interested in the fine arts. And when I finally made my way to college, I started painting and I started making photographs. And well, I don't know if I was making photographs, actually. I was learning how to take pictures. Mm-hmm. But I dropped out of both programs and I started to write instead. I was always interested in nonfiction and in poetry, mm-hmm. actually. So I finished my undergraduate degree with a minor concentration in creative writing, and it was a liberal arts degree with that concentration. But then, I don't know, 4 years later or so, in my late 20s, I returned to graduate school and I studied photography then. Mm-hmm. The painter and artist in me just has always been present, and in 2014 I saw a show of charcoal drawings by Joan Mitchell, who's probably the painter that I look at the most. And I thought, okay, I really have to do this. I really have to start exploring drawing. So I enrolled in January 2015 at the New York Studio School of Drawing, Painting, and Sculpture. And I spent 3 years there. I thought I was going to take a drawing course. Uh-huh. And in fact, I took eight intensive drawing marathons, they're called. And then I started painting. It's all from life, so perceptual drawing and painting. And I started painting and even took a sculpture marathon. Wow. It's one of the most important things I've ever done in my life. Mm. One of the most important experiences I've ever had. I don't know if it completely changed, but it had a great impact on my photography practice and on my teaching practice, on the way I see and the way I experience the world, the way I understand light and shadow, the way I think about color and color relationships.
Wow.
It was, in fact, I was just in touch last night with Graham Nixon, who's the dean of the school, the fearless and fierce and incredibly wise, compassionate teacher. And I told him in writing that maybe he knew that my time at the studio school would make an impact on everything that I made going forward, including my photography. But I had no idea, and it surely does. And it's now it's so present with me as I'm making cyanotypes now.
Right.
And I draw from my experience in everything that I make, whether it's a photograph or a cyanotype, and whether it's a photograph in the landscape or a portrait or a still life, they are all informed. Everything is informed by what I learned at the studio school in terms of thinking about seeing relationally, about space and color and light and negative space and positive form and shape and how perspective really both mental perspective and actual physical perspective or vantage point really are an important influence factor in everything.
It's so inspiring to hear you speak about this. And I just, it's a reminder too of how much, you know, we think of art forms so often as just distinct and different, and they're really, there's so much crossover, you know, and I personally have felt that deeply with writing and photography, you know, being in an MFA program for writing, but also because my other obsession, and I think obsession is the right word, is photography. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and being in classes and TAing for class to teachers like you, and hearing about the art form and how on both of them metaphor is at the core of it, you know. So it really excites me, actually, you know, when you're speaking about these different ways that they inform each other. It's really cool. You know, I wanted to talk to you about you. I know you mentioned that it's only recently, more recently, that you began doing portraits, and mm-hmm. and you have a series on your website. You can find it of this expanded view of the word family. And we were talking about family mm-hmm. earlier before we started recording. But mm-hmm. I so appreciate in your work and also in just the way that you speak about the people in your life, and you use that word family to talk about not just, you know, the bloodline, but people that are family to you. And I'm mm-hmm. thinking of Lori is her name. Is that right? Lori, your best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And
I
noticed the way you, I think it was in class the other day that you, when you spoke of her, I think you said we were celebrating our 27th year anniversary. And that was so lovely to hear, because we don't talk about that enough, about celebrating these milestones in friendship, you know? I don't have a fully formed question here. I just wanted to talk to you about that, about that importance to you and the language mm-hmm. around it.
Mm-hmm. So about the family portraits or what?
Yeah, well, we can talk about that, but also just the word mm-hmm. the word family and what that means to you.
Yeah. Gosh, it's so complex. And it's so extremely relevant to my life now, because I, as you know, I'm in North Georgia at my partner's family's home, and where I was invited in March 2020 when the pandemic intensified in New York. And so I feel like it has been a time of learning about family in a way that I have never known before, because I, in many ways, did not have a family. And I surely did not have a family like the one I know here, the presence of two parents, of mother and father. I grew up with my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, as my primary caregiver. And as I mentioned, my grandfather was present for the first 4 years of his life. I did not know my father. His identity was kept from me until my mid-20s, which is when I met him for the first time, briefly for a weekend. I had two aunts and two uncles who were present, and cousins who were present in my early life. but a close, loving family, I did not have any semblance of whatsoever. I had an extremely ruptured family. I mean, really, it's almost hard to use it's almost hard to use the word to describe what I experienced in my early life. So, and that, of course, has informed my whole life and my photographic work, everything that I make. But I am so fortunate, so incredibly fortunate to have cultivated a chosen family over the course of my adult life. And I have long relationships and friendships, many, many friendships, as we've mentioned, with Laurie for 27 years. I have other long friendships, and also long relationships with colleagues. And former students, some students actually who have been studying with me for a decade. Wow. So I started photographing people for the first time in 2017 when I was finishing Another Way of Looking at Love, which is a way of using the natural world as metaphor to explore themes related to connection and the human desire and yearning and need for connection. And there was a natural, it wasn't planned, you know, nothing really in my work is planned. It is also intuitive. It evolves very organically. One day I saw a portrait of my former partner and one of our beloved golden retrievers, Gracie, and I wanted to make that picture, that portrait. And so I started photographing on the property people who visited, family who visited. And then I realized that, well, so much of my family, my chosen family, is in New York or passes through New York. And so I brought my camera back to the city and I started photographing some, not all, of these very special people in my life My partner Forrest, not my current partner Forrest, friends, collectors, a dear friend Laura, who visited from the Bay Area, and her children, her husband Kamran. I photographed, of course, Gracie and Dolly, my golden retrievers. So I have this not complete body of work of, and there are so many other people that I can, like you, photograph. So we'll do that, Monse, when you come to New York.
Oh, I would love that. I'd be honored.
We could make a portrait of you.
Thank you so much for sharing all that. And it made me think to ask as well, just on the topic of family, because you just shared so much. And I was thinking about how, I think I wrote you recently, or, you know, I mentioned to you that I, maybe it was over the phone, I can't remember, but I just started, I mean, maybe just 2 months ago, work a writing piece on a segmented essay on this sort of this ambiguous loss of not being a mother when I always thought I would be, for sure, which is now translated to a work. I'm also working on a project, in a photographic project on this, and they may cross over, they may be separate, I don't know yet, but I think I was telling you about this, and you mentioned that you too had written in part about this topic. And if it's not too personal, I'd love to talk about it with you a little bit.
No, I'd be happy to.
Because I just think it's something, I mean, maybe I just haven't seen it enough and it is out there, but I think it isn't talked about a lot. What is talked about a lot is, you know, people who really wanted motherhood and, you know, couldn't have it because of the, you know, maybe or wanted biological motherhood, I should say, and couldn't have it, you know, because of well, one reason or another. But I think there's this also this very, like, there's a space that it's nuanced, you know, where it's when it's not so black and white, and maybe that's, to me, I think, not talked about enough, and it does sort of leave a little bit of an emptiness. At least that's what I'm finding, you know, is when there's so many different factors that have contributed to kind of being almost 40 now and seeing that door slowly closing. And it's just interesting too, this thing about art, in that, you know, I found myself sort of having all this energy towards this work, of wanting to make this work. And it's just so interesting how art sometimes shows us what's important to us at that moment, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
So anyways, yeah. Again, don't have a question. Just want to talk to you about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I love the idea of art showing us who we are and what matters to us, revealing through that very honest, intuitive, organic process, learning about ourselves, revealing ourselves through our work and discovering something about ourselves. I've learned a whole lot about myself through my work. But actually, I wanted to mention a collection of essays that Megan Daum edited.
Yes, I just read it.
Yes, oh, did yes, you?
I'm saying, oh, it's not good. Talked about a lot. Of course, I'm forgetting that. That's right.
Yes, yes.
That's absolutely right. Yes. That's a beautiful, beautiful collection.
Yes.
What is it called? It's called something about, I remember Selfish is in the title.
I read it right after it was published.
Let me look it up for people that are listening.
10 years ago. Actually, I'm not even sure if I read it. Rather, I heard her lead a public talk about it with some writers right when it was published.
Okay, just so people have the title if they're interested, it's called mm-hmm. Selfish, mm-hmm. Shallow, and Self-Absorbed, 16 Writers on the Decision Not to Have Kids.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And well, she wrote a piece in her collection of essays called, I believe, The Unspeakable.
That sounds right. I think you're right.
If you haven't read it, you must read it. It's an extraordinary collection of essays. I love her brave, bold voice.
Yes, me too.
You know, daring to say what we're not supposed to say.
Absolutely.
Well, yeah. So, yeah, motherhood. I thought that I would be a mother too. Mm. And in fact, when I began my relationship with my former partner, he reversed his vasectomy so that we might have, so that we could have children. That was big.
Yeah.
And painful.
I'm sure. I know.
And generous and loving. And I think that I needed so much healing before I could in good conscience assume the responsibility of another life. Sure. And and that healing process has taken so long and is still in process. I turned my attention to my photography practice in my early 30s after I finished graduate school when I was 29, and really fully immersed myself in it because I, you know, it's really the only way to do it. And then, and not that this is a substitute for having children, but I did get a golden retriever named Gracie.
I wanted to talk to you about the role of animals. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, they are so important to me. Yes, in defining who I am, apart, you know, going back to your first question, apart from an artist, definitely a lover of animals with a deep, deep connection to them. So Gracie came into my life in 2004, and shortly thereafter, months after Dolly came into my life, we were living in Mexico at the time, Mexico City, and and I could take care of them, and I could love them and give them, you know, and obviously they have a lot of different needs, some very similar needs, but a lot of different needs from children. And I could fulfill that role and responsibility to them. And I did it. I did it extremely well. My interest in having children of my own really waned. And I thought about it again when I fell in love. My relationship with David ended some years ago, and I fell in love. And I felt the desire, possibly for the first time, the real, true, authentic desire, to be a mother. And it wasn't a conceptual idea. Born of an emotional need to fulfill something. I believe it was a biological yearning from very, very much born from out of being in a loving relationship, being in love. And sadly, it was too late. I wasn't able to conceive.
Well, thank you so much for so vulnerably sharing all that. You know, I think it's, I think a lot of people will, I don't know, just find some solace and comfort in the fact that they're not alone, you know, in that story, because, you know, you're certainly not. And I think you pointed to something with the animals, you know, and just reminding that there are so many ways to mother. And I actually was thinking about Pam Houston's essay as you were talking about that, because, I don't know if you remember that one, but it was in the collection, and she's very much, and I think you are as well, you know, very much a mentor to many people, and a great lover of animals, and nurtures and takes care of them, and just, she's one of the most motherly people I know, but she doesn't have any biological children. And I just think it's a good reminder that there are many ways to mother, you know. Thank you for sharing all that, Janelle. And it's really
wonderful. You're so welcome. Yeah. Well, I wanted to have an honest conversation with you, Monse. I like you do in this podcast. And I also wanted to, it's refreshing, you know, it's what I'm interested in. And I also wanted to share here what I don't typically share publicly. And I thought that, I don't know if I will necessarily, but, much like the creative act of making or writing, one of the things that I love about doing making or writing is that, well, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, I learned something about myself. So I was wondering if today, during this honest conversation that we would have, I wondered if I would learn something about myself, discover something as we're talking. I'm very open to doing that.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, I feel that I've already learned things about myself and you through this conversation. Yeah, it's, I think like all good conversations, you know, and it's true, you know, we, you know, even the most, earnest people, I think, you know, we hold things in unknowingly sometimes, and it's just a relief and release to be able to talk about things that maybe we didn't even know really mattered so deeply to us, you know. But
And also to move past embarrassment or shame.
Yes. And it's amazing how we hold on to that for so much of our lives, no matter, you know, you think of it as something that, I don't know, that we grow out of, but I think we often don't, you know, the shame. And it takes a lot of work to unravel that. Well, you know, I would like to ask you, actually, before I get to this other question, I want to, since we're on the topic of shame, can I ask you sort of how you work through, this is a newer question I've been asking everybody, is how do you work as an artist? How do you work through rejection? And maybe, maybe I can add to that shame, you know, that feeling that that's, that rejection sometimes brings up.
I have had a lot of rejection,
as we all have
in my career. And I was thinking about in my career. I mean, in my life. Yeah, fortunately, in my career right now as a photographer, I have been. It has been a time of really being acknowledged and celebrated after you know, working very hard for many years, and after a lot of rejection. I did get a rejection the other day from a piece of writing that I submitted, and I was surprised by it because I thought that it was good. And you know, and the thing is, it might be good. Yeah. In fact, it just is perhaps not the, it was not the right fit perhaps for the journal. So you know, fortunately at this point in my life, that's kind of where I went. I was like, oh, I'm surprised. And, well, is it, you know, and my writing practice is still so, it's so very young. Even though I have been writing, for a long time, it's not something that I have dedicated myself to a consistent practice. So I am still very much a young writer. And so there was first like, oh, well, maybe it's not strong enough. And then I thought, well, you know, actually, maybe this journal doesn't really publish this kind of... this kind of lyric essay. Oh, yeah. And so it was a very compassionate, fair response that I had to rejection.
You know, can I just pause on that for a second? Because,
of course,
you know, just being right now in an MFA program, in writing, I hear a lot that to be a writer is to be rejected over and over and over again. You know, and I've heard from teachers who have said, who are very, very accomplished in their field, you know, and they still get many rejections. And one of them was telling me recently, actually, that a piece of hers that has been rejected by lesser journals that are, you know, less known is now, you know, a finalist for a prize in a very prestigious journal. And that just drives home the fact how subjective it all is, you know. But it's interesting as you're saying that, because, you know, I'm very aware, you know, in the writing world how incredibly common rejection is for even those that are at the top of their game. But I have never once even submitted anything for photography contest or publication or anything. So I don't know. Is it equally as filled with rejection as it is in the writing mm-hmm. world? I'm assuming yes, but
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think especially in the earlier phase sure. of one's career, when there is a lot of that, a lot of submissions for juried exhibitions right. and prizes. So I am no longer there now, but I was there and spent many years there, and surely had my share of rejections, and did not, was not as kind and compassionate and rational with myself right. As I am now. So yes, keeping in mind subjectivity is essential, because it is very much, well, it's one of the factors, subjectivity and of course politics. What are the themes of the moment that the juror has to respond to, or what if there is a prize or a grant that's funded, how the funders have to respond to certain things in the greater world, and how that makes an impact on what's selected. Yeah. I wish that it were the case that it was about merit, but it often is not.
Sure. And also just the fact that, sometimes they have just accepted something that's similar to what you're presenting, and that it could just be as simple as that,
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
But it's interesting. I was speaking in my last conversation for the podcast about this, about how it is so interesting how, to be, as has been told, that I've heard many times, to be a writer is to be familiar with rejection. I mean, I think to be an artist, mm-hmm. period, is to be familiar with rejection. Mm-hmm. And but yes. what's so interesting mm-hmm. about that is that I think artists we're the most fragile and sensitive among humans, So it's mm-hmm. just like the sort of the those two things don't go so well together, but we have to learn, And I don't know. I think I'm personally feeling like it's a muscle I'm strengthening, Whereas mm-hmm. like,
great. Mm-hmm.
So anyways, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. The last writing workshop that I did wasn't long ago, and somebody in it said that they were working on getting their 100th rejection yes. this year, like actively working toward it, and because it's part of it. And
there's a great essay on that somebody wrote about getting to 100 rejections mm-hmm. a couple years ago, I think, and it's great. It's been, I think that's been that that piece, once it was published, now it's become a goal of many people to say, okay, I'm going to try to get to 100 this year.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, Janelle, my last question for you, and I am skipping over some general questions I normally ask, but the reason being is because we have a beautiful interview with you up on the Musings of the Artist site that you've already mm-hmm. answered some of these, so people mm-hmm. can go there as well. But I would love to ask you, because we are coming to the close of this year, and we're going to begin a new one in, 2 weeks now, I think? So what are you most looking forward to in the new year or hopeful for?
I'm making things. I have been here at Fern Valley, like I mentioned, for the last month, and really quite well. Some days each week I've spent immersed in my practice of my new practice of making cyanotypes, and I'm really enjoying them, really interested in seeing what comes. It feels related to my photographic work, but because I'm not depicting the real world, it's allowing me to make contact with the world that I know is there, but I can't perceive through my senses. And it's very exciting to, I have tried and to represent to this world or to suggest this world photographically, and for over 20 years, beginning with my thesis work, but I think that I am able to do something with the cyanotypes that I am, something new that I'm very excited about. So I am looking forward to, making things in, possibly in solitude. I don't know where, I don't know when, but I am looking forward to, it was a very intense year, with a lot of exhibitions and a lot of teaching. And so I am looking forward to time to make things, to make cyanotypes, to make photographs, to reconnect with my drawing and painting practice, and to possibly do that somewhere in nature.
Oh, that sounds perfect and lovely. And yeah, you're getting me excited for what's to come. So thank you so much, Chanel. You are just, as always, inspiring, and speaking with you is so nourishing. And and I'm really grateful for you.
Thank you so much. This was a pleasure. Thank you, Monse. I love talking to you. Un abrazo.
I was going to say adios. Ciao, ciao. Adios.
Adios. Yeah. Adios.
Musings of the Artist is audio produced by Aaron Mooring, and theme music is by Madison Ward.